Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This month's tape is presented by Phil Van Hooser. Phil is one of the most highly respected inspirational business speakers and trainers in the United States. During the past 9 years alone, Phil has created and presented over 1,800 programs for more than 350 different organizations, from Honolulu to Heidelberg and from Toronto to Tulsa. A member of the National Speakers Association, in 1993, Phil was awarded the coveted Certified Speaking Professional designation, an honor earned by less than 280 of the organization's 3,500-plus members worldwide. A gifted storyteller, Phil Van Hooser combines an entertaining, content-rich presentation style to masterfully communicate his lessons from life learned as a corporate manager, hog farmer, professionally trained baseball umpire, grave digger, and now successful entrepreneur. Phil possesses a unique ability to combine hands-on managerial experience with workable solutions and strategies for the challenges experienced in today's changing workplace. Get ready to experience this rare combination of content, energy, practical application, and personal inspiration as Phil Van Hooser shares his presentation, Leading the New Breed of Employees.
As a professional speaker and trainer, I have the opportunity to go out and talk to a lot of different groups. Oftentimes, if I'm going to do a program of one day or longer with, say, managers or supervisors, I will start the program by asking a very simple question. If you could get one thing from this particular program, what would it be? Well, people will tell me, I'd like to be better at managing my time. I would like to learn to make decisions more effectively. I would like to be better able to control stress or be a better communicator. And, of course, the list goes on and on. But the one statement that I get more than any other single statement from that particular question is this: help me motivate my people. Help me motivate my people. Tell me, show me, teach me how to motivate my people. I have to look them in the eye just like I will look you in the eye and tell them, I can't. I can't tell you, I can't teach you, I can't instruct you or lead you to a point of being able to motivate your people because of a very simple principle. And the very simple principle is this: you and I both know that you can't motivate anybody to do anything unless they what? Want to do it. Fundamental human relationship or fundamental concept of human behavior. You can't motivate anybody to do anything unless they want to do it. So, to expect a trainer, be it me or be it anybody else in this United States for that matter, to teach you how to motivate people is going to be an exercise in futility. It's simply not going to happen. And then I hear statements say, but Phil, it's more complicated than that because the people I'm working with are different than they used to be. Have you ever heard that? The employees coming into the organization today are different. How many people have heard, or more important, how many people have said that? Oh, yeah. You know what? Listen to me very carefully. They are different. Just like you and I are different, they are different. The people we work with are different. We can't be surprised by that particular fact. So our program today and our focus today is going to be very clear, very focused in prospect of what we're trying to accomplish. What we want to understand is not that they are different. We accept that. That's a given. Instead, we want to know what's different about them. What's different about them? I would suggest to you that the presentation is titled Leading the New Breed. There is a new breed out there, and it's a breed that's going to continue to evolve and change and establish themselves in organizations, not only for the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. It's going to be a continual process. And for those of us who learned to lead or began our leadership education at an earlier time, we have a lot of changing to do. We have a lot of re-understanding, remaking to do. And it starts by understanding this new breed. I want to suggest to you as we start this particular program that if we're going to talk about the new breed, we need to understand what the characteristics of the new breed are. And I would suggest at least three characteristics represent the new breed of employee, the new breed of child, the new breed of student, the new breed of customer that we come in contact with. All right? As compared to the previous generations. Let me give you the first characteristic of the new breed. The first characteristic of the new breed is they are the best informed generation in history. Now, I stress that word informed as opposed to saying the best educated generation in history. Now, frankly, I used to say they're the best educated generation in history, and I'd have people jump this high out of their seats. Well, Hopeville, wait a minute. What about dropping SAT scores? What about folks that when we hire them don't know how to fill out an application? What about people that can't make change over the counter? What about a functional illiteracy rate nationwide that's at 12.5%? Don't tell me, Phil, that this new generation is the best educated. And so I had to drop back. I had to reestablish. And I determined that maybe they're not the best educated. It's arguable. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But it's almost without question that they're the best informed generation in history. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky. When I was growing up, we got three television stations on a clear day. On a cloudy day, we got one. Now, just a few years later, my children come in after school, they turn the television on, and immediately choices ranging from 30, 40, 50, 100, depending upon if you've got a satellite or whatever, immediately present themselves before them. They take that little switcher, which we also didn't have when I was growing up, they hit it, they run through all 53 channels, and as soon as they get through it, they look around and say what? There's nothing on. Isn't that amazing? Information. Now, it's interesting, but we can go another step further. I look around this room. We have several males of the sort of middle age range. I'm asking a question. How many of you all in here are Vietnam vets? Can I see a show of hands? Okay, we've got probably 10 or 12 in here. For those of them who just raised their hands, and frankly for the rest of you as well, you will know that the Vietnam War is oftentimes referred to as the first war that was ever fought in our living room. Is that right? And of course what that refers to is, it was the first conflict, the first human conflict as compared to the Korean conflict or World War I or World War II or some of the others. It was the first conflict that actually showed images as it was happening in our living rooms, people who were not participating actively in that conflict, we were seeing what these gentlemen that raised their hands were about at that particular point in time. Now that's a stark change in terms of what had happened previously. Previously, what we had seen is movie reels or news reels. And basically what they were just staged reenactments of things that were happening, always with a predetermined way of how it will end. And at that point in American history, it normally ends with the good guys winning in the end, right? Vietnam, all of a sudden, now is reality. Now all of a sudden, we're seeing our brothers and our sons and our neighbors and our husbands or fathers. And they're there, they're suffering, they're bleeding, they're dying, and they're doing it all as we're having dinner watching Huntley and Brinkley. All right? Very important note to make about that particular point in time. And the note that I would make is very simply this. Even though we were seeing those images, and as a result of the images that we saw and the thoughts that they evoked and all that went with that, our attitudes began to change about how we felt about things. It forced us to think about things in a way that we had never been forced to do so before. But we were looking at filmed footage. I want to stress that. Filmed footage. Meaning that some photographer, some camera operator, had in fact shot that footage 10 days to 2 weeks ago somewhere in Southeast Asia. They had gotten that film out of those bogs, out of those rice fields, had in fact put it on a transport plane, mailed it back or shipped it back to the United States. It went to New York or L.A. or Chicago or someplace, and in some editing room somewhere, there were editors and producers that were watching that film and saying, we need 37 seconds on the evening news. Let's find 37 seconds to to use in this particular report on this particular activity. Now, I don't want to sound like a cynic, but let me ask a question, and if you will, answer this question out loud for me. Is it possible, I'm not saying it's probable or that it was even done, but is it possible for you to take 37 seconds of pre-selected film or whatever length you want to say, and if you precede it with the right comments and then follow with the right comments, you can basically get that 37 seconds to say anything that you want it to say and thereby lead other people to believe whatever you want them to believe, yes or no? Compare the Vietnam War and the information we received regarding it in the early to mid 1970s. Fast forward to January the 16th, 1991. For those of you who remember that day, you will recall that on that Wednesday evening, most of you were probably sitting in your living room with the television turned on, watching the reports of what was going on in the Persian Gulf area. You were probably tuned to CNN, and if you were tuned to CNN at that particular moment, you heard a reporter from a sixth floor Baghdad hotel window say, "I think I just saw a Patriot missile go by my window." And you, being the pragmatic people that you are, said, as I did, "Get to the basement, you idiot." Let me ask you a very important question. The observation that that reporter made, the communication of that observation, and the message that you received, do you know how long it took for it all to happen? According to telecommunications experts, the entire event, the witnessing, the reporting, and the receiving of that encounter, of that event, 12 to 17 seconds, depending upon atmospheric conditions. 12 to 17 seconds for that person to witness something, to observe it, to report it into a machine, for the machine to ship radio waves to a satellite several hundred miles above the Earth, for the satellite to collect those waves, ship it at least to one and possibly two other satellites on the other side of the world, down into receiving stations in New York, L.A., Miami, Chicago, into your local television stations, into your living room, into your ears, 12 to 17 seconds. It is conceivable that missile had not even hit its target, and yet we, right here in America, in the comfort of our own home, knew it was in flight. Is that information? See, and that is just one example of the information that this new generation is bombarded with continuously. We have more information. How we process it, how we use it, what we learn from it is arguable. But the fact of the matter is, we are in the information age, and we are in fact bombarded by the information that is contained in the information age, coming from telecommunications, coming from technology such as computerization, and you can go on and on and on. Number one, there's one thing that you cannot disagree with, I don't believe, and that is that this new generation is the most informed or the best informed generation in history. But they have another characteristic. The second characteristic, they are the best or most mobile generation here in history as well. We're shooting this videotape for those folks who may be listening at home in the state of Florida. You need to know that because the question I'm going to ask right now, how many people are native Floridians? Oh. Fairly significant group, about maybe half, 60%. That means the rest of us sitting in this room today are from somewhere else, right? Of course, the native Floridians are thinking at this moment, why don't you go back there? If, in fact, we have come here from somewhere else for a particular purpose, it is fairly safe to assume that if necessary, we will what? Leave again. We'll go again. Why? Because we are, in fact, aware of the mobility that is available to us. Now, understand, this is the first generation. Now, with certain exceptions, certainly, but this is the first generation that has ever thought, ever grown up thinking that when I get out of school, when I, in fact, get a job, I am going someplace else. Our previous generations have expected to be born, to be raised, to be educated, to work, to marry, to raise families, to die in the basic general vicinity of where it all started for them. Is that true? See, we are expecting to have the opportunity for mobility, and in fact, if in fact we don't experience mobility, we become frustrated. I came from Kentucky to live in Florida. I came by choice, but I came for a reason. If necessary, I certainly would, in fact, leave. Now, that's not necessarily true of some of the folks that I have had reason to spend time with in the past. I have a father, excuse me, a grandfather-in-law, Otto Alsebrook. He came with the wedding. Otto Alsebrook is pushing his mid-90s. It's very important for you to understand some things about Otto Alsebrook. Number one, he's one of the wisest men I've ever known, and yet he never probably got out of grade school. He had to go to work, had to work on the family farm to support the family. All right? So educated, at least formal education, he is not. But, on the other hand, you can learn a lot from him. Let me tell you a couple things. Number one, Otto Alsebrook has lived and owned the same farm for roughly 70 plus years. 70 plus years. He has never traveled for more, by his own admission, has never traveled more than 100 miles away from home in his life, and then only on two occasions. Once to go to Evansville, Indiana, from his home in western Kentucky to take off a load of tobacco. A second time to go to Nashville, Tennessee, to visit a son who had had emergency back surgery. He has never, never spent the night in a hotel room in his life. It probably should come as no big shock to you. He's never flown in an airplane. Now, you need to understand something about Philip Vanhoozer. I'm a fairly goal-oriented individual. I love setting goals. I love working toward goals. I love the accomplishment of goals, the satisfaction that comes with that, and love reestablishing new goals. When Susan and I, soon after we married, I saw Otto Alsebrook as a goal in the making. I told Susan, I said, I'm going to get your granddaddy to fly. She said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. She said, you're good, but you ain't that good. I said, but if I work on it, if I focus on it, if I talk to him, if I explain, if I educate him, he will in fact understand the joy of flying. And so for the next 2 years, I literally worked on Otto Alsebrook. I talked to him. I got close to him. I was sharing with him. I spent time. In fact, in reality, what I was trying to do was manipulate Otto Alsebrook. That's okay. He went along. Everything was fine. And I remember the particular day, a Saturday morning. The day had arrived that I thought, this is the day. It's a perfectly blue sky, beautiful weather, wonderful for flying. I got in my car and I started driving to Otto's house. I remember driving up the gravel road. I saw him out under the maple tree. He was sitting out there in a rocking chair. I hadn't even got out of my car. I sort of got stepped halfway out of the car, hollered over the hood to Otto. I said, Otto, what are you doing? He said, you're looking at it. I said, good, come get in the car and go with me. He said, where in the world are we going? I said, Paducah, Kentucky. 45 miles down the road, Paducah, Kentucky. He said, what in the world for? That might as well have been 1,000 miles for him. I said, because we're going to go down to Paducah, Kentucky, and I'm going to buy us two airplane tickets. Me and you, and we're going to get on an airplane in Paducah, Kentucky, and we're going to fly to St. Louis, Missouri. We're going to get out at Lambert International Airport, and we're going to walk around, and I'm going to show you how transportation and how the mobility of America comes together in the form of airports and airplanes and the like. I'm going to show you. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to educate you. Otto, come on and go. I'll have you home in time for supper, I promise. Folks, I was sincere in my wish, but I had lost sight of Otto Alsebrook in the short term. Let me tell you exactly what Otto Alsebrook said to me. He looked at me and he said, son, I appreciate it. I really do. But I don't intend to get any higher in picking peaches nor no lower in digging taters. You could say that Otto Alsebrook was not very mobile. Now, the interesting thing about that story is this. When my children, his great-grandchildren, get old enough for me to share that story with them, you know what they're going to say. When I tell them about their great-granddaddy not being willing to fly and this, that, and the other, they're going to look me in my eye and sincerely say, you lie. And you know why they're going to say that? Because it's totally out of the realm of reality for them. They have all flown. Even my little one-year-old has flown already. The point being that the new breed being informed and mobile, but they also have a third characteristic that sort of brings this all into full circle. The third one is they are the best protected generation in history. And the protection I'm referring to, of course, refers to legal protection. We know our rights. And by George, we'll stand for them. Now, you put those three things together. You put information, you put mobility, and protection, and you sort of mix them all up, And what you've got is the new breed of employee. It shouldn't come as any surprise to you that when you walk to an employee and you give them an instruction, in fact, telling them what you want them to do, it should not be a surprise at all when they look at you and say, "Why?" And like the old Fred Sanford television show, you remember, you grab your heart, you start falling out, "Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you." And you give the same message, you say the very same words that you've heard your parents and your former bosses say when they ask the question, "Why?" What's the response? "Because I told you to. That's why." At which this new breed will look you square in the eye and say, "I don't have enough information on which to base my decision. If you'll be kind enough to share that information, I'll certainly take it under advisement and get back with you when I've made my decision." Now, it's a predictable response. And it's one that leaders need to be prepared for, because you are not motivated by what you have. You're motivated by what you don't have and have determined that you want or need. And what this generation has grown up with is information, mobility, and protection. They're not motivated by having it, but if you try to withdraw or withhold it from them, they're so motivated they'll do and behave and act in ways that you could have never predicted before. The new breed is not something to turn our back on. It's not something to say, "Oh, I don't understand it, so therefore I'm not going to work with it." What we must do with the new breed, if we're going to be effective as leaders in organizational America today, is we've got to understand what makes them tick. I'm going to share with you some information right now that can change your life. Now, I realize when people come to training programs, they don't come to have their lives changed. They come to get some information. They come to get a new technique. They come to get a new way of working through a problem that they may have. But I certainly don't come to get my life changed. And so therefore, when I stand before you and I say to you that the information I'm about to share right now has the potential to change your life, some of you are already thinking he's overstated his cause. And I don't buy it. But stay with me for just a second. If, in fact, your relationship in your life changed, does that change your life? Yes or no? If your relationship's improved, does your life improve accordingly? Yes or no? If your relationships go south on you, does your life suffer accordingly? Yes or no? So therefore, if you have a better understanding of why people do what they do, then you should be in a position to positively change your life for the better, because you're in a position to understand the relationships and the behavior associated with the individuals in that and perform accordingly to trying to accomplish the goals and objectives that you set forth. That's what I'm going to share with you in the next few minutes. I call it the nature of human nature. It all starts with the common, sort of the cornerstone of this particular concept, and it simply is this. All human behavior is directed toward satisfying some sort of need. All human behavior is directed toward satisfying some sort of need. Now, there's some very important words in that statement as it sinks in, as you play it over in your mind. There are some very important words. Need is a very important word. There's no question about it. All human behavior directed towards satisfying some sort of need, be that need real or perceived, that's important. Behavior, that's what we witness. That's what we have to deal with. That's an important word. Satisfaction of those needs, that's important. But I would suggest to you that there is one key word. Several key words in the statement, but one key word that in essence is more important than all of the others combined. The word is the three-letter word that starts the statement. All. It does not say, the statement is not, most human behavior is directed towards satisfying some sort of need, or even some human behavior is directed towards satisfying need. The statement says, all human behavior is directed towards satisfying some sort of need. Again, be that need real or perceived. Now, if you can accept that statement as a matter of fact, as a statement of fact, then immediately it becomes unnecessary and even a waste of time, for that matter, to ever ask one particular question again. What's the question? Yeah, why? Why? Why did he do that? Why did she do this? Why won't they do what I want them to do? I'm telling you, I know the answer. And you do too if you believe the statement. They won't do what you want them to do. They are are doing what they're doing for one reason and one reason only. They believe that their behavior, their actions, are intended and are in fact accomplishing the satisfaction of a need that they have. That's what we look for. That's what we look for. Now, when I say you eliminate the need to ask one question, the why question, don't misunderstand. There's another question that immediately jumps in its place. What is it? What? What need would drive this individual to perform, to act, to behave in that particular way? Instead of asking why, which is a wasted, worthless question, we start to focus on the what. And therein lies a significant change in terms of our leadership processes. When you ask the question, what, you're actually performing, at least mentally, in a progressive or proactive way, as opposed to when you ask the question, why, you're responding in a reactive or responsive sort of way. Let me give you an example. How many in here, in your organizations, have some sort of preventative maintenance system established in some way, form, or fashion? Can I see a show of hands? Oh, several. 75, 80, 90%, whatever. Preventative maintenance, by its very definition, basically assumes several things. Number one, preventive maintenance assumes that things are going to break down. Sooner or later, things are going to break down. Is that true? Yes or no? It also assumes that those breakdowns can, in fact, be delayed or overcome if we take certain actions at a particular point before the breakdown occurs. Is that a fair statement? And according to Murphy's Law, if breakdowns occur, which are certain, they will always happen when? At the worst possible time for the individual or the organization or whatever. So in reality, preventative maintenance is intended to keep bad things from happening at terrible times. Instead, we would prefer to take preventative action, to take a machine out of action, do the maintenance, do the repairs on it before it becomes problematic, so that, in fact, we will experience the positive nature of that decision later on down the road. That's why we change the oil in our car every 3,000 or 5,000 miles. Because we don't want to be on the interstate at 3 o'clock in the morning and all of a sudden our engine blows. We would rather pay to have it done before it becomes totally necessary than, in fact, to wait till it becomes too late. Well, I'm going to suggest to you, as certainly as there is preventative maintenance, there should be preventative leadership. Now think about it. Preventative leadership. Leadership that focuses on taking people out and maintaining them in a way that is necessary to service their needs before their needs become unserviceable and therefore they break down within the organization. Or said a more practical way, you need to start talking about to people about what their needs are before those needs have not been satisfied or before those needs become a problem. You need to ask them. You need to observe them. You need to observe others in relationship to them to get an idea about this follower that is so key, so important to us as individuals. Because all human behavior, everything they do, everything they say, everything they think, is directed towards satisfying a need that exists within them at that particular point in time. Now, that's the fundamental cornerstone of this process, the nature of human nature. If you accept that, it's not going to be hard for you to accept the rest of what I'm going to share with you. On the other hand, if you struggle with that, it may be difficult for you to accept the complexity, not complexity, the depth of what I'm going to share next. Because, see, if in fact we are working to satisfy needs, all human behavior is working to satisfy needs, we must understand the second point, and that is that people will take the easiest route to satisfy those needs. People will do what is easy. Notice I didn't say they would take the shortest route. I said they'd take the easiest route. Have any of y'all ever taken a shortcut in your life, be it in travels or maybe even in your career? You took a shortcut, got about halfway out there and said, Lord, I wish I'd have stayed on the beaten path. I have. See, we want to take the easiest route. Now, sometimes we end up going off on the wrong tangent, going off in the wrong direction, because we think that will be easier. It turns out not to be. But we take the easiest route because that's what we perceive it to be. Let me tell you a quick story. I have a son, Joe. Joe is now 8 years old, but about 3 years ago, I learned a lesson about motivation from my own eldest son. Joe, I was sitting in my living room one afternoon television room, actually one afternoon reading the paper, and all of a sudden the back door bursts open and in runs Joe. Now Joe, it's obvious to me, has just gotten out of the swimming pool. He's totally soaked, water dripping everywhere, and he's running across the living room. He's never thought about toweling off. All right? And he's running across the living room, slams the door behind him. He's heading for the door that leads into the garage, which leads out to the front of the house. Almost as an afterthought, he sort of says over his shoulder to me as he runs, "Daddy, I'm going next door to Mallory's. I'll be right back." Mallory happened to be the little girl his age that lived next door. And they played together all the time, which was not a problem. The problem that I had was he was soaking wet and he needed to put his shirt on. So I said these words to him, "Not before you get your shirt on." He continued moving across the living room. He said to me in response, "But Daddy, I'll just be right back." He kept moving. I said, "Not till you get your shirt on." He kept moving. "Daddy, but I'll be right back." He gets to the door. He turns the door knob, opens the door, starts, "Not till you get your shirt on." Now, at my house, I'm the DH, the designated hollerer, okay? The decibel level finally got up here to such a point that it forced him to stop and pay attention to what I was saying. Now, you got to get the picture in your mind. Here's this little five-year-old boy standing with his hand on the doorknob, door halfway open, looking over his shoulder at his dad. A thought occurred to me at that particular moment in time. The thought was very clear. The thought is specifically this: I am not saying another word. I've already said three times what I intended. Is that right? I'm not going to say another word. But on the other hand, I was also smart enough to know I should not start reading my paper again. Because if my eyes would have gone down to the paper, where would my little boy have gone? There, you're right, he's gone. So you got to understand there's this standoff that's occurring at this particular moment. Joe's looking at me, I'm looking at him, and he starts to, as he said it at the time, "I need to explain something to you, Daddy. But Daddy, I'm just going next door to see Mallory. But Daddy, I'll be right. Daddy, I'm going to just be there." At some point, Joe stopped, turned loose the doorknob, turned his full attention to me, and said these very, very important words: "Daddy, I don't get to go next door to Mallory, so I get my shirt on, right?" What a brilliant child, you know? I said, "Right." At which point, without any further discussion, he wheeled. He did not turn. He wheeled, rushed out of the house, out the back door. I got up, watched him run across the backyard. He ran to the pool deck, never stopped. The shirt was still there where he had taken it off. Scooped it up, running, putting it back on, runs back in the house, shirt three quarters of the way on. "Daddy, now I'm going next door to Mallory's." At which point I said, "Go on." That's very important for you to note something, because I learned a very valuable lesson that day. Joe had a need that he was attempting to satisfy. And the need was very specific. He had the need in his mind to get next door to Mallory's. But the thing that sometimes we miss is that the need, the immediacy of the need, drove his behavior more than just the need itself. He had determined he needed to get next door to Mallory's when? Right now. And it wasn't the shirt. Not once did he say, "Daddy, I don't want to put my shirt on." He just kept saying, "I want to go next door to Mallory's." He was telling me what his need was all along. But when he finally came to the realization that the longer I stand here and complain and try to talk my way out of it, the longer my need is not being satisfied, it's much easier to go get the shirt. When he made that determination for himself, all the action took place after that. Do you understand? I'm going to suggest to you that people will take the easiest route to satisfying their needs based on two basic directions. I've already said needs are important, and I'm going to share with you what I believe to be the two universal needs, but I'm going to hold that off for just a minute. Before that, I want to share with you what I consider to be the four universal fears. People will take action to avoid fear. They will also take action to satisfy needs. Now, let me ask you a question before I give you these six. All right? Now, this is the toughest question that I will probably ask in this entire program, so I want you to think about it before you respond. I'd like for you to vote with your hands, if you don't mind. How many of you all know, those of you who are supervisors, and this makes it even tougher, how many of those of you who are supervisors, who have people reporting to you, have someone that works for you that you do not like? See a show of hands. Folks, thank you so much. That is a very difficult question to answer publicly. All right? And some of you probably did not raise your hands for fear that somebody might know who it is that we're talking to, which is fine. But keep in mind these thoughts as we go through this, because there's an important point I want to make in just a couple of minutes. Four universal fears that drive people's behavior. I'll start with the fourth and work my way up progressively to the greatest fear that it has. Let me give you fear number four. The fourth greatest fear, the fear of failure. The fear of failure. People fear failure so much that some people will not even try anything new. Yes or no? Now, probably if I did a quick survey of this room, most of you would say, that doesn't surprise me that the fear of failure is on the list, but number four? I thought it would be greater. Number one, number two at least. All I can say to you is just bear with me till you hear the other three. The fourth greatest fear is the fear of failure. The third greatest fear is the fear of success. People fear success, I believe, more than they fear the failures that they experience. Why else would you go to somebody and say, hey, did you see that job posted on the board? I thought of you immediately when I read that job. And they say, I know. You know? Yeah, sure. You know that you'd be perfect at that job? Yeah, sure, I could do that job. Probably the best one that ever did that job. Well, why in the world don't you try it? Now listen to this. They look you in the eye and they say, well, if I did that, they'd probably want me to do something else down the road someplace. They don't fear failing. They fear succeeding. They fear, and which brings us to number two, frankly. They fear the unknown associated with that success. The unknown. You'll hear people sometimes say, and in this, again, this life that we have, this changing environment, work and otherwise, that we experience, you hear some people say, we fear change. The people that I work with fear change. Most people, and I would even say the vast majority of people, do not fear change. They fear the unknowns that come, that are associated with change. If we can eliminate those unknowns, we can deal with the changes. Now, that's not to say that we like all the changes, but see, we can even adapt to the bad stuff. Somebody once told me that for 100 people, 99 people out of 100 can handle adversity. Only one can handle prosperity. Now think about that. I've often thought, well, why is that? Why can 99% of 100 people handle adversity better than prosperity? And the only answer I can come up with is they get more practice. Isn't that right? We are turned down more than we are granted. We have to be, people tell us no more often than they tell us yes, and we learn how to deal with that. That brings us to the single greatest fear that people experience, I believe. The single greatest universal fear, in my opinion, is the fear of rejection. Rejection. Now, if you don't like the word rejection, substitute a couple of words. The fear of separation, the fear of alienation, the fear of isolation. We fear being alone and apart from others. We are communal beings. We like to work together. We like to live together. We like to socialize together. We like to play together. We like to eat together. We are that kind of people. And if in fact we start to find ourselves being isolated or alienated for some reason, that is a terribly strong motivator for us to do something about it. You know, it's interesting. Those of you who have children, no matter what their age is, but especially teenagers or above. Let's just talk to the people who have had teenagers above. Let me tell you what I believe you've done. I have not had teenagers yet. I have friends that have. I have a sister and relatives that have. But this is what I know happens in reality. Because we love these children so desperately, what we'll do when they're starting right down here, we'll start talking to them. Darling, please, please. And they start to grow, you know. Darling, please, don't drink and drive. Please don't drink and get behind the wheel of a car. It's just too dangerous. And listen to me. Don't ride with other people who are drinking and driving. Here, take this quarter. It's always available. I don't care where you are, what time of the night, anything. You call me before you get in a car with somebody. I'll come get you. That's how much I love you. And please, please don't experiment with drugs. Please, they're so addictive, and you don't know what your thresholds are and what you can handle and what you can't. And please, please, in this day and time, no premarital sex. No premarital sex. The diseases and the pregnancies and the morals and oh, please. And you tell them these things for one very simple reason. You love and care for your children. And you've told them for years up until that point at about 13, 14, 15. It's different for different people. But at some point, all of a sudden a knock comes on the door and your child goes to that door and there's one of his or her buddies. And within minutes, you see them both go headed for the driveway to get in a car. And immediately, you start to what? Worry. Now, it's interesting. All of us have the same experience, but what we don't always take the time to do is understand why we are worrying. Are we worrying because we have not communicated what the fears and the problems are? No, heavens no, we've been doing that for 13 years. What we begin to worry about is that issue known as peer pressure. Peer pressure. Oh, come on. Everybody's having a beer. Have a beer. Come on. I wouldn't care. Oh, come on, you wimp. Come on. Or come get in the car. We're going down to the convenience store. Well, you've been drinking. What do you mean drinking? I can drink. I can drive. You know, that's no problem. Get in. No, no. Oh, come on, man. Take a hit. Make it feel good. Everything will be wonderful, right? Or how about this one? Oh, yeah, baby. I love you. All of these things are designed as peer pressure, and the reason you start to worry about them so much is because you can immediately think back to times in your life when you have succumbed to the pressures of your peers. And none of us believe that our children are stronger than us, their parents, and so therefore, if we have succumbed to those peer pressure points, we immediately assume that our teenagers, that our prodigy, will in fact do the same. And none of us believe that our children are stronger than us, their parents, and so therefore, if we have succumbed to those peer pressure points, we immediately assume that our teenagers, that our prodigy, will in fact do the same. That's scary. I did not see this news report with my own eyes, but I wish I had. A friend of mine shared it with me. He said he was watching one of the news magazine programs, and they were interviewing a guy that was, I think he was 97 or 98 years old, pushing 100, you know? Pretty significant. It's significant in this day and time to get on up there, but they were interviewing this guy, and they came to him, and they said, and frankly, my friend said it was a pretty boring interview, because the interviewer was asking very predictable questions, like, how did you live this long, and, you know, and all that stuff. And the old man was answering the questions, but basically, you know, he was bored. Because he'd been asked those questions before. My friend said that the interviewer finally happened upon a question that was a good one. I'll tell you that the question is a good one, but I'll tell you the answer is even better. The interviewer apparently looked at the old man and said, "What's the best thing about being 98 years old?" Now think about that question. There's not many. You're about dead. And even if you're not dead, man, things are starting to break and fall off and, you know, this is not a comfortable time in life, you know? And so when you ask a question, if you're an interviewer, you need to ask a probing question that forces a thoughtful answer. What's the best thing about being 98 years old? Apparently, the question took the old man back because he did not respond immediately. They said he started to stroke his chin and look up and think on camera. Finally, after a few seconds of thoughtful consideration of the question, he apparently turned his attention back to the camera and responded. Listen to his response. I'll tell you the best thing about being 98 years old. The lack of peer pressure. Think about it. The problem with that answer is simply this. If we have to live to be 98 years old, many of us will never learn that valuable lesson. Is that right? Wouldn't it be better if we learned that lesson at 58, 48, 38, 28, 18, maybe even 8? See, that's when we need to understand how important it is to have our focus on satisfying needs as opposed to satisfying fears. I told you that's the four greatest fears. Now, if those are the four universal fears, let me give you the two universal needs. Now, I already told you the greatest, the most universal of the fears is rejection. So, out loud, you would tell me that the greatest need universally would be what? Wrong. Not acceptance. That's number two. Number two is acceptance. Number one is attention. The greatest single need that we have is the need for attention. Now, stay with me for a second. Let me give you an illustration that's happened to me. I mentioned my little boy, Joe. I have two daughters, by the way, too, and somehow Joe is just different than them. There's several activities I don't like in life, but one of the activities I dislike the most is going to the grocery store. I do not like going to the grocery store. I used to ask Susan to come in and say, "Phil, I'm going to the grocery store. You want to go with me?" I'd make up something. "No, darling, I was just getting ready to go do this, that, or the other," you know? She has gotten much smarter. She now comes up to me and says, "Phil, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." She said, "Good, come to the grocery store with me." Now, what it always happens, it's not as bad now that Joe is up in age, but when he was a little guy, it always happened. We'd get to the grocery store, and Susan would say to me, "You take Joe, and I'll watch Sarah." All right? Well, what taking Joe meant was put him in an empty cart and just following along as Susan shopped. But that was an adventure in and of itself because of what Joe would do. We'd start down the highway, you know, and we're walking down the highway, and immediately Joe would start saying, "Daddy. Daddy! Daddy! Hey, Daddy!" And of course, I would continue on with my journey, whatever it may have been, totally what? Ignoring Joe. And the reason was very simple. I knew what he was going to say. If I said, "What, Joe?" he would say, "Can I?" I would say, "No." He would say, "Why?" I would say, "Because," and therefore we're in a mess. Y'all have been there. And so I opted for chosen deafness during those period of time. I just keep pushing, just ignore him totally. Well, I'd get to the end of the row. Joe would realize, because his need was not being satisfied, he would realize, hey, this ain't working. And so I would think mistakenly for a moment that Joe had forgotten. Had he forgotten? He's just thinking, how do I change my behavior? How do I up the ante a little bit? And so the next thing you know, we'd start down the next row. Pushing along, he'd look up at me and he'd say, "Phil! Phil!" Maybe even pat my face. "Hey, Phil!" Now, you stop right there and you say, "Why in the world would a child do that?" I'll tell you exactly why. I walked by and he said, "Daddy, Daddy, 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 Daddy." I haven't said a word. I passed three people in the aisle. They said, "Hi, Phil, hi, Phil." I said, "Why? How are you doing? Good to see you, you know." And he starts to say, "Well, at the grocery store, he doesn't respond to Daddy. It's only at home." So at the grocery store, he responds to Phil. So I just call him Phil. Does that make sense? But see, I think, what a brilliant child. He's obviously got my gene pool, you know. But he's not smarter than me because I'm not going to respond to him at all. And so I just keep going. I think it's cute, but I don't say anything. We get to the end of the row, and he shuts up. And I think, well, he's forgotten. Has he forgotten? We get on the next row. He shifts his behavior. One more gear. We're going down the row. He doesn't say anything this time. He simply reaches out and scrapes off about five mayonnaise jars in the floor. Now, very important two questions I'm about to ask. First question is this. What was Joe desirous of? My attention. Did he get my attention? Yes. Now, very important point. Did he know that the attention he was going to get when in fact he broke these mayonnaise jars was going to be different than what he had hoped for? Yes. Now, here's the point. People would rather get negative attention than no attention at all. I asked you a question a while ago. Some of you respond to it. I said, do you have people that work for you that you do not like? Several hands went up. Let me tell you, the basic human behavior, the predictable, expected human behavior for people that you do not like is to avoid them. But we've already heard that the greatest fear in life is to be rejected. The greatest need is attention. So in fact, we wonder why some people perform in a negative light. It may be it's the only attention they get in their entire organizational existence. What am I saying to leaders? What am I saying to proactive leaders? I'm saying find those people that you don't like and then work to find something you like about them. Spend time with them. For heaven's sakes, don't reject, alienate, isolate them. Because you're just asking for some sort of surfacing of a problem, an emotional problem that they certainly are going to have to deal with themselves. People will take the easiest route. But when needs, number three, when needs are not satisfied. Because frankly, we said a while ago, all of our needs are not going to be satisfied. We recognize, we understand, we accept that. When needs are not satisfied, there are three predictable responses to unsatisfied needs. Mark them down. I cannot tell you that they will happen in a particular sequential order, but I can, in fact, tell you that these things will happen when needs are not satisfied. One thing you can look for is this. People will withdraw. Withdraw. Now, there's two kinds of withdrawal. There's the most obvious form of withdrawal, and there's the most common form of withdrawal. The most obvious first, physical withdrawal. They take their ball and go home. They don't want to play anymore. I've had all the fun at this organization I can stand. I can't take anymore. I'm leaving. I'm gone. It's very obvious because they're here today, gone tomorrow. Not a problem. But that's the most obvious. It's not the most common. The most obvious, Physical withdrawal, they quit and leave. The most common, emotional withdrawal, they quit and stay. Some of you have experienced that. They quit and stay. Why? Because they can't afford to quit. They're not to retirement time. They got a mortgage. They got bills to pay, etc. But on the other hand, don't ask me to do anything. Don't ask me to commit myself to particular tasks. Don't ask me to serve on that committee. Don't ask me what I think. I'm going to do just enough to get by, not enough to go far. Now, some of you at this particular point need to be very, very careful. Because some of you at this particular point thinking, boy, I know some people like that. Boy, I can give you names. You want names, Phil? I'll even provide names, you know, for heaven's sake. What we don't recognize is that I said this is a common human behavioral pattern of all people. I'm going to go so far as to say that everyone under the sound of my voice at this particular point have experienced exactly the same thing. Now, I cannot predict for certain that you have physically withdrawn from something. You probably have, but I can't predict that. What I can predict with certainty is that I know for a fact you've emotionally withdrawn from something. And not only that, I can tell you the thought that you had right before you emotionally withdrew. Here's the thought. Why am I beating my head against this wall? Why am I working so hard? Why am I trying? Nobody else around here is trying. That thought, or that series of thoughts, is the precursor to some sort of withdrawing behavior on your part. Now, some people say, well, that's okay, I'll give you that, Phil. That happens to me. But I didn't let it keep me down. After a while, I sort of got my thoughts back up, and I came back up. Why are the people that I've known, they're like that for 10 or 15 years? Let me tell you why. You all are special. You wouldn't be in this room listening to this leadership presentation if you were not. Somebody has determined there's something special about you that would indicate that you are a leader, or at least have leadership potentialities. So therefore, they send it. You are special. You can lift yourself up. There are a lot of people that don't have the same skills, the same drive, the same determination, the same abilities as you. So when they, in fact, are withdrawn, listen to me, a leader's responsibility is to lift down, reach down, and lift them out of that. Very important. It's an awesome responsibility. Awesome. Withdraw. Let me give you the second thing. Predictable response. Not only will people withdraw, they'll also get aggressive. When needs are unsatisfied, they're going to get aggressive. I'm going to share something with you, and I don't know who, obviously, in the room, but someone in this room right now, someone on this tape right now. This is the most important thing you're going to hear in this entire presentation. When you find someone who is uncharacteristically aggressive, mark it down. They have a serious need that is not being satisfied, and it needs immediate attention. Now, all of us know people who are characteristically aggressive. It's just their nature. But we also know people that it's just totally out of character for them to act or behave or speak or say or do the things they've done. When you notice someone who is uncharacteristically aggressive, please don't put it off. It needs your attention immediately. Because you cannot predict what they will do next in terms of their behavioral process. People will withdraw. People will become aggressive. But number three, they'll also begin to rationalize. Unsatisfied needs forces people to begin to rationalize. Now, I'll give you my favorite definition of rationalization. To rationalize is to tell rational lies. Think about it. The word rational, logical, believable, acceptable. The word lie, untruth, fabrication, misinterpretation. So you put those two words together. A believable untruth told to ourselves. That's scary. That's scary when we can create a lie, tell it to ourselves, and then start to believe that lie. And yet it happens in organizations, it happens in family units, it happens in work departments, wherever. It happens all the time. Why? Because they are so desperate to find a way of satisfying a need that otherwise they have not found the way to satisfy, that they start to conjure up things. As a leader, you need to be aware of these manifestations of unsatisfied needs so that you can step in and realize that the only way to reverse the process of aggressiveness or of withdrawal or even of rationalization. The only way to reverse the process is by satisfying the needs, or at least working, attempting to satisfy those needs with the individual. Now, we get to a particular point and we start to realize that unsatisfied needs are a problem. There's no question. But we also go to the fourth level of this progressionary process, and we start to realize that one need may result in many different behaviors. One need may result in many different behaviors, but let's go ahead and give number five. Number five says the same behavior may come from many different needs. So that sounds the same. Is it the same? Uh-uh. One need may result in many different behaviors. Let's say we have a need for more money, as so many people do. There are many behaviors that you might employ to get more money. Think about it. You might work harder. That people will notice that. They'll reward us for that behavior, that the performance, that we'll work hard. Or we'll go back to school. We'll get smarter. Or how about this? We'll work overtime. We'll work longer. Or how about this? We'll take another job. That'll be good. Or how about this? None of those work, so I'll go and ask for a raise. Just sort of plead for a raise. Or I'll demand a raise. Or how about this? I'll steal. Or how about the Great American Way? I'll suck up. It works for some. Now, let me ask you a question. I've lost count, 7 or 8 different ways to get more money. And there's certainly more ways than that. But I gave you 7 or 8 different ways. How many of you all would be willing to do literally all of those things I just said just to get more money? Not one person. Now, let me ask you a second question. How many of you all can imagine that there's someone out there that would be willing to do one or all of those things to get more money? Ah. We might not be able to do it, and so therefore, when we're working with people, how many times have we said, that's not the way I would handle that, but that's not the only way to handle it. Just because you wouldn't perform, just because your need is not such that would drive you to a particular point of performance or behavior, does not mean other people would not go further than you would go. That's what you need to know. One need may result in many different behaviors, but the same behavior may come from many different needs. I've mentioned my wife several times. Let me tell you something about Susan. I have seen Susan cry when she's happy. I've seen her cry when she's sad. I've seen her cry when she's physically hurt, but I've also seen her cry when she's emotionally hurt. What's that say about my wife, Susan? She's a crybaby, of course. No. That's not what it says. What it says is she's human. And she has certain needs. Now, if I go to her and I say, oh, you're crying, you must have stumped your toe. She's liable to grab me up by the collar and look at me real quick and say, hey, boy, you don't realize you hurt my feelings a while ago. That's what's making me cry. He said, well, what does that have to do with a professional organization, a professional group like this? How many times have you had an employee that started missing a lot of work? Because as you investigate, you found out he and her husband were having marital problems. And you said, well, boy, you need to get some help. Maybe you even offered some professional counseling through the organization. And they went off and get some help. And pretty soon, sure enough, their attendance improved. And you feel very good about yourself. And you should. 6 months later, you look at the attendance records one day, and all of a sudden you notice there's a trend here. This person is missing more work. You immediately assume, what? Oh, there they go again. They cannot keep their stuff together at all. And you go to them and say, well, you and John or you and Janie must be having problems again, huh? They say, what? Well, you're missing work again, just like 6 months ago. And they look at you and say, you idiot. You don't even realize we've never had a stronger marriage. What we're going through right now is we have an exceptionally sick child, and you should have known that. And all of a sudden, the same behavior is a result of a different need that they're attempting to satisfy. And we, the leader, have not found that out about they, the follower. And as a result, our relationship suffers. I've said before, you've got to know your followers. You've got to know them, where they are and what they're doing. But that brings us to number six. Number six simply is the point that I would make that many of you all are already familiar with, and it's that perception is more important than truth or reality. Perception for many, many people is more important than truth or reality. In fact, perception becomes truth and reality for some. The way they see it, the way they perceive it, is the way they believe it to be. Yes or no? You believe that? Let me tell you something. I've been professional speaker and trainer for almost 8 years now, and I love it. And I've always gone into programs with a certain desire and determination that I'm going to share things that I think are important with people. And this issue of perception has been one that's been important to me for a long, long time. I've always believed that there are certain skills that you need to master and perform admirably with. But there are also issues out there that we need to be aware of as it relates to how people perceive what we're doing. Not just what we're doing, but how we are perceived in what we're doing. I remember several years ago, I had an opportunity to do a program, a training program, and they invited me to come in and do a two-day, 16-hour pre-supervisory training program. Their intent was to take this group of employees who had never had supervisory experience in the past, to take them, to give them some skills, some training, etc., that would prepare them in advance for promotional opportunities that were certain to come. And I want you to know, I've never been as excited about a program in my life, because I kept thinking to myself, I can go and I can take 35 people who don't have any bad supervisory habits. I can give them the good stuff, and it's going to be the greatest bunch of supervisors ever been known to mankind. You know, I was pumped. And I went in, and I was giving them skills that I thought was necessary and the things that they needed. But I also continued every opportunity. I told them perception. You got to look like, walk like, talk like, act like, smell like the professional you want to be perceived as being. And I believed it, and I reinforced it at every opportunity. And by the time the second day was over, I was just confident that I had accomplished my task to a great degree. At the end of the program, we had the group fill out an evaluation. They filled out the evaluation. As they left the room, they dropped the evaluation in a box at the back of the room, and off they went. As soon as all 35 had left, I went back, I collected the evaluations, put them in my briefcase, immediately headed for my house, pulled into the driveway at my house, went in the back door. Susan's there peeling potatoes at the sink. Give her a little peck on the cheek, kept going. Little kids, Joe and Sarah, playing in the floor, a little pat on the head, kept going. Immediately went into my office, shut the door, reached for my briefcase, pulled out those 35 evaluations. Because, see, I wanted to review these evaluations while they were still fresh on my mind. Folks, I read 34 of the best evaluations you could ever hope to get. Then came number 35. I have thought many times since that point, was it accidental or incidental or even coincidental that this one was the last one, literally the bottom one on the pile, or did its author shove this one under the bottom of the pile and say, wait till you get this one, big guy? I don't know the answer to the question, but I do know what that evaluation said. The evaluation went on to say, Phil, the program was good, blah, 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 blah. But the question was, if you could suggest something to make this program more effective, what would it be? The respondent said, and I quote, Phil, I suggest if you're going to wear a white shirt, that you wear a better quality t-shirt. What? I must have misread that somehow. I looked at it again, read it again. Phil, I suggest if you're going to wear a white shirt, that you wear a better quality t-shirt. How'd I start to feel, folks? I was mad. Neck started getting red. So it's like, who they think they are talking about my underwear, you know? I want you to know, I stood up in my office, as certainly as I'm standing before you right now, and I literally took off my tie and pitched it in the floor. I took off my shirt. I didn't understand. I pitched it in the floor. I proceeded to pull the t-shirt off, and as I did, I noticed, what? A hole about the size of a quarter right there in my shoulder. Now, I'm about to tell you the most embarrassing point of this entire presentation. I knew it was there when I put it on that morning. Now, wait a minute. I wear a t-shirt for one reason and one reason only. I sweat. You've seen it. I always do. I work hard. I move around. I sweat. And I believe that if you wear a t-shirt, it's intended to catch sweat. It looks better to sweat into a t-shirt than it does all the way through your shirt. Yeah, I saw the hole in the shoulder, but I'm going to put a whole other shirt on it. That t-shirt's good for another 100,000 miles, you know? And I put that t-shirt on, put my shirt on over it with confidence, and I went on about my program. What I did not recognize or think about was that even though I can't see that flaw, at least one other person who's willing to write it down saw the flaw in the shoulder, right? And they watched it, and as I'm talking about perception and professionalism, they're saying, isn't that a hole in his shirt there? Well, as I'm standing there, folks, it begins to sink in. I'm beginning to learn. It's not a pleasant lesson. It's not a comfortable lesson. It is a lesson. But don't you, when you ever get caught with your hand in the cookie jar, don't you like to share the blame a little bit? Susan! Come in here! She should not have let me go out looking that way, should she? Susan, just a minute later, opens the door. I'm standing there half-naked, hands on my hips. She should have known something was up, you know? She said, what? I said, I want you to read this. And look at the last one on that last page right there. Read it. She takes it and she reads it. When she finishes, she just very, very subtly flicks the whole thing down in the floor. And she puts her hands on her hip and throws that hip out of joint. I said, what do you think? She said, I think it's pretty dang picky. That's what I think. She's a good Kentucky girl, too, by the way. She talks like that, too. I said, I did, too. But you know what? Susan knows what I do. She's worked with me for the last 6 years in this business, building a business, and she knew that we had messed up. You know what we did? We did two things in rapid succession. Number one, we took that T-shirt and threw it in the rag bag. But secondly, we went back together into the bedroom and pulled out the drawer. We did a quality assurance check. Because it had become very clear to us that it was more important for us to go out and spend $12, $15 on new T-shirts than it was to run the risk of making the same mistake again. I want to make a very important point in closing here. The point is very simply this. People ask me sometimes, don't you get embarrassed telling that story? Not in the least. Not in the least. Because, see, that story enabled me to learn a very valuable lesson. Here's the lesson that I learned from it. Here's the lesson that I would share with you. The lesson is simply this. It's not a sin to make a mistake. It only becomes a sin when you make a mistake that you know you should have corrected, but you didn't and went forward with it. I made that mistake just out of ignorance. I just didn't know any better. But after someone made me aware of it, if in fact I would have been willing to go back out there with the same T-shirt with the attitude that I don't care what you think, that's when it becomes a problem. I've heard managers. Notice I said managers. I did not say leaders. I've heard managers say, I don't care what they think. I'm not here to get people like me. I'm here to get a job done. Folks, they don't understand the significance and the magnitude of perception. Because, see, if that's the attitude that you have, and if that's the attitude that you project, either with your words or with your actions, then folks, perception is everything, and people will treat you exactly how they believe you to be that good or bad. I told you when we started this particular program that I was going to share some information with you about the new breed. And I also thought I could share with you some information that would hopefully, if you took it to heart and tried to apply it, could change your life. I hope that I've done just that.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. And don't forget, if you haven't ordered your Service Sense tapes for your technicians, give us a call today at 1-800-432-7963. How else could you train your technicians in customer service for only $99.95 a year? The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.